TFM.
Welcome, Stargazers, to another episode of The Artificial Tango, our dedicated Star Trek Picard podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, as soon as you figure out how to break out of those handcuffs, we'll get this podcast going.
Well, I would be feeling great, Chris, if I could do that. But, you know, I don't have a Borg queen living on the other side of my psyche. So, and how that gives one power, I'm not quite sure. But I'm really interested to figure that out.
Yeah, it's all about the hormones and the enzymes and all that stuff there, Matthew.
And I was never good at chemistry, so.
Well, today we're going to be talking about the sixth episode of Star Trek Picard Season 2, Two of One. And here's a quick rundown of the story. The gang prepare to enter the Europa Mission Gala, only to find that Agnes has yet to inject their fake IDs into the system. And that's because she is still handcuffed to a chair. To break free, she must give the Borg Queen more power, a move that might break her free in more ways than one. Once in the party, Jean-Luc is able to convince Rene to make the flight, but is injured in the process when he is run down by Adam Soong, working on behalf of Q. After Soong reveals to his daughter that he had failed her, revelations about his true nature and experiments are revealed, giving a dark twist to the story. But Matthew, that's just a little bit of what happens in this episode. There's so much for us to discuss, so let's just jump right in. And I thought maybe we should start with the two Picards, because the whole Rene story and convincing her not to give up is so central to this episode.
Yeah, I mean, this is what a lot of the season has been building to, which is, you know, we found out that this character, Rene, is being pushed around by Q and doesn't even know it. And so Picard needing to give her a pep talk is so classic TNG, you know, Picard needing to give somebody a speech, which he is so good at. And yet, what I think is great about this is that for him, this is so much more personal than many of the other speeches that he's had to give somebody. I mean, this speech is literally to his, you know, great, 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 great grandmother. I guess that's as many greats as we need. I don't know. Maybe we need another one. But so for him, you know, if this doesn't happen, so much ends for him. His own life, most likely, the entire history that he knows. Everything is going to fall into chaos if he doesn't make this speech and do it well enough. And yet, one of the things I was really struck by was just the vulnerability and obvious emotion that is coursing through Picard as he's giving this speech, and how difficult it is throughout the speech, because there is this thing that is going on in the background for him, this emotional connection with his mother and everything that he's kind of continually been reliving. And with all of those things playing in there, I thought that that was really well done. And so I really enjoyed this. And I think what he says to her is really, really interesting. And I'm interested to get your take on it, because, you know, he talks about the idea that fear is fear. Mm-hmm. And it means you're smart, you understand the risks. But then his mention of this idea, you know, you have to follow the light and trust the light and all of that. I felt like it was that part of the speech where maybe I wish it had been a little bit stronger, because the idea of like following the light seems a little bit too ambiguous, really, for what we're talking about here, which is the struggle with depression and melancholy.
Yeah, I can understand that. I think that, well, you pointed out he says fear is fear, and that line, I especially liked the way it was delivered. because we know that Q has been telling her that fear is a reminder. And she parrots what Q told her in an earlier episode. Sometimes fear is a friendly reminder. You're not ready for something. And Jean-Luc says no very forcefully. Fear is fear. It doesn't speak in riddles. Now, I don't know if I agree with him that fear doesn't speak in riddles and it's always so clear cut, but I think that for the story, his response was just what it needed to be. And it was delivered in a way that, you know, Patrick Stewart can deliver a line where it weighs on you like that. But I felt like, I think he was trying to be very gentle with her because he doesn't want to push her too hard. He doesn't want to scare her. So the part about there is a light, sometimes only a glimmer, trust that light, find a way back no matter what it takes. I think the find a way back no matter what it takes strengthens what he's saying a bit more than if he had just said, sometimes there's only a glimmer and you need to try to follow it. But the overall scene I thought was a highlight of the episode because it was that quintessential Next Generation moment with Jean-Luc Picard where he talks clearly and gently and in a heartfelt way to someone and it helps them through a situation. And that's where it felt very true to Picard for me.
Well, and I mean, too, yeah, I think one of the things that they did nicely is, you know, obviously even in the scene, you get a chance to connect to Enterprise, you know, with the opening credits and having that shuttle there and that being the way that he kind of brings her out of her over emotional state of just being so ready to kind of quit and like not even understanding how to talk about anything, not being ready to talk about anything. So he gets her on a different subject and it just immediately kind of calms her down because it also gives her the chance to talk about something that she loves,
Exactly.
That she's very passionate about, you know, which he had no idea of knowing. She just happens to choose something that, which I think is kind of great.
Well, I mean, but she's become an astronaut, so he knows that she has this love for the space program and the space flight. And then that shuttle is an iconic piece of space history in this story. Mm-hmm. So it was not a gamble at all. I think that it was a clever way for him to guide her to something that she loves and feels strongly about that grounds her and pulls her out of this situation that she's in where she's feeling like she has to quit. And then he can talk to her and deliver this nudge to stay with the program, to go on the mission.
Right. Yeah. And I think what was also just kind of nice about the whole thing is it does continue to kind of connect us to the way in which this story is emotionally connected to everything that's happening with Picard and, you know, his mental state. And I actually, too, really loved the moment where she asks him, she's like, are you sure you don't want to go to Europa with us?
Yeah,
you
right.
know, and all I could think of was, you know, and I'm wondering if running in Picard's mind was, well, I mean, we were far to first contact. I mean, why, you know, like,
I thought he might say, no, I've already been there many times. I don't need to go.
Yeah. you know, it's just not as exciting as you think it's going to be.
That's right. You should check out Io. You're going to love it much more than Europa.
Exactly.
Give her a little nudge there. While we're talking about this, because that ending there, we have on the outline later actually to talk about Picard's flashbacks. He has them throughout the episode because of the story structure where we start the episode with him lying on the ground after being run down by Soong. And then later he's in the clinic. And then all through this time, here and there, we're getting these flashbacks. And what really stood out to me in particular on a rewatch of this episode is the final exchange with Renee before they head outside. She says, your mother was very lucky to have you, after he says, you remind me a bit of my mother earlier. But there's a flashback there as well. And there's an expression on Patrick Stewart's face that I think reflects some kind of great sadness that he failed his mother. And you and I talked a little bit on messaging about these flashbacks and what we're seeing happen. And then I froze it on this one scene where it looks like someone who is possessed, some kind of creature, but also looks a bit like Picard, like Jean-Luc himself, is pulling his mother away. And I'm just, I'm wondering what happened. Was she killed by his father? Was he not able to intervene and save his mother? Was she abducted by someone else? You said you had a few theories.
Yeah, so I had been doing a little sleuthing and came across some stuff on Trek BBS, and they pointed me in direction of an interview that Patrick Stewart gave, which Patrick himself says this: Picard gradually comes to understand that his belief that his father was a bad guy and his mother was a victim was not necessarily the truth. That a horrible thing had happened to his mother, she was responsible for, Stewart reveals.
That she was responsible and for.
And his father was in every possible way trying to do things to help her and failing to do them. And Picard has hidden himself from that knowledge for maybe 50 years, but now he's facing it. And as such, it would appear that he is now going to make commitments of the kind that he could not make when we first knew him in The Next Generation, which we've talked about some of those ideas, and I think we absolutely have come to some of those conclusions. The idea that there isn't anything untowards here for the father is very interesting. And so as I was thinking about that, and then thinking specifically about what we're seeing here, I am wondering if what we are seeing are young Picard's manifestations of what's wrong with his mother, the melancholy and the depression, which we know can be quite severe for people and cause terrible things for them to do, right? And I'm wondering if his father was not able to save her from herself, which is that maybe she committed suicide or something
that
like
makes
that.
Sense.
And therefore, what we're seeing again is this manifestation of the darkness that lurked in his mother. And that's because it would make sense for a young child to kind of create that in their mind, I think. This thing that is, you know, destroying his mother.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't want to see it as being something that is specifically a part of his mother. He would rather see it outside of her. So that's one of the places that I'm thinking that this is going to go, especially as we dive into Picard's psyche in the next episode. So I have no idea if I'm right, but it does seem to me that as if we're pointing in that direction.
Right. So just to clarify, if I understand, the creature that we see at the end of one of these flashbacks, you're saying maybe a manifestation in young Jean-Luc's mind of whatever is happening inside his mother's mind that's pulling her away.
Yes.
Not an actual creature. He's like giving some kind of embodiment to that mental state. Yeah, that's very interesting and would make sense for what we're seeing, I think, as I watch it. I think that we've been led through the season to think that maybe his father was abusive and his mother was trying to get away from his father. And even in this episode, it feels that way in some of the early flashbacks. But as the episode goes along, we start to see that, no, there's something else going on. It's not what we've been led to believe up to this point. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's quite interesting.
Yeah, I don't know. How are you taking it as you were watching the episode?
Well, I think as I just described, that as I was watching, especially the first time through, up until the later flashbacks where there's clearly someone else involved, someone's pulling her away. His mother says, "Find me," which I think is
right.
It makes sense that she would say that if she's calling out for help, because internally she feels lost. Like she needs someone to help pull her out of this melancholy or this malaise or whatever is happening in her mind. And I think it was like the second or third time I went through the episode, maybe the third time, I really noticed the face, and then I paused it and I took a photo because I can't screenshot on the thing here. And I sent it to you and I said, this is the person pulling her away. What do you think? So yeah, I think that's how I was taking it, as still abusive father until late in the episode. And now I feel like, yeah, something else is going on. And because we see that in this conversation with Renee about her melancholy and her fear, then it connects. And maybe it's something that runs in the family as well, which has been mentioned in the season already.
Well, and it just seems as though, you know, when you think about this whole idea, it would make sense that when we go into Picard's mind, there is going to be there something for him to face. And so having kind of seen this face, and it's the same thing that to which I think what we've been saying this whole season is that it's something that also has kind of lived in him in some ways, connected with what happened with his mother. And that's kind of, I think, kept him in fear of, you know, ever really going deeply with anybody else in the way that he would actually want to. And so I think that's something that's this really interesting. And so I think what we have gotten a taste of is actually just the thing to which Picard is probably going to be facing down, the manifestation of what he's going to be facing
down. The manifestation. One other question I had, which I think we'll probably discuss next time, because I think we'll learn a lot more in the next episode, is that what we're seeing happening with Jean-Luc makes sense for this story, but how do we reconcile that with the Jean-Luc Picard that we've known for so many years, where we haven't seen this type of thing weighing on him? Now, of course, in the writing, it didn't weigh on him because they hadn't written the story yet. But just thinking about how we reconcile that.
Do you think, and just to touch on it here, because maybe this is part of the answer, which is the compounding nature of things like all the stuff we saw that happened in season one, you know, the loss of the Federation that he had loved, the loss of Data kind of coming to plague him. Just the losses mounting to which, and even just his own mortality in the last season. I mean, we deal a little bit with the idea of the fact that, you know, he's not quite human anymore here. And so therefore I could understand why, in light of season one and all of the losses that Picard has faced over his life, it's finally compounded to this shattering point to which has made him have to deal with that, which again comes face to face in the sense that in episode one, Laris asks him to be with her and he cannot do it. And so that there is again this shattering point for him where what he desires is that, but he can't make himself move forward. And so it's begun this reliving of all of this trauma. And I think maybe that's part of the answer. And if that is the case, I think it's the best use of season one. And it's also the best way to, I think, finally help us understand why Picard basically never got it on with Crusher and they got married, because they obviously cared deeply for one another and should have been in a relationship if he had been emotionally available.
Except for the command structure, which I think with someone like Jean-Luc would prevent him from taking that step. But for Beverly, it would have been fine. All right. So last point I want to make while we're talking about Jean-Luc and Renee before we transition to the next thing is the Japanese title of this episode. I found it really interesting. The title of the episode in English is Two of One, which, of course, any Star Trek fan would take to be a Borg designation. And we've got the whole Borg Queen and Agnes Girardi storyline. But the Japanese title is Futari no Picado, which means two Picards. So the translators took the Two of One to refer to Jean-Luc and Renee and literally called it two Picards. And I don't know if that's just the translators being less familiar with Star Trek and not really catching the Borg reference, or if it's a cultural thing because of the family component of Jean-Luc and Renee, because family is much more important in storytelling in Japanese culture compared with American culture. But I just found that really interesting.
Well, and I do think that there is a double entendre there.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Which I think is great. Yeah. You know, so they picked up on one of the double entendres. Yep. And of course, there's the second one, which does reference the Borg.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was my immediate thought as well, is that it works. Two of One works for both of the storylines.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not surprised that they went with the literal Picard title in Japan, however. Okay, so Two of One. Let's talk about the Borg Queen and Agnes, because we've been predicting this for weeks now that Agnes would become the Borg Queen, and she has. And boy, when it finally happens, how creepy was that smile and the eyes? I thought, like,
it was great.
I thought, Alison Peel, how can you do that perfectly creepy Borg Queen smile like that? It was really something. But anyway, what did you think about how this all played out from the moment that she needs the Borg Queen's help to get out of the chair because she knocks out the security people, but forgets that she's not close enough to do anything? And the Borg Queen looks so annoyed, like, what a rookie mistake. So starting from that point to the point where the Borg Queen gets her to sing a song so that she can take her over fully.
Well, what I thought was fascinating here is that Agnes thinks that she could control the Borg Queen.
Yeah, right.
Which is like trying to rein in the devil.
Yeah.
That it just doesn't work, right? You know, there's just no way that's going to happen. And so she doesn't realize that this entire time she's being played by the Queen. And what's great about that, too, is that it ameliorates, I think, one of your frustrations with the previous episode where you're like, why is this happening? Why are we having this moment? Why, you know, it's that Agnes specifically realized, okay, there's a way for me to get what we need and still control the situation, which obviously the Queen is all more than happy to play this. I mean, she's like the quote-unquote Sean Connery from Celebrity Jeopardy. I'll play your game, you rogue. and I think that this is phenomenal because the whole time, you know, we've been playing on this idea of that she's been building up the idea that Agnes has all this potential with the Queen, and she's been feeding her these ideas that, you know, she doesn't have to be alone in all of that. And I think Agnes, in some ways, likes some of the things that the Queen is allowing her to do, which is to be less afraid and more action-oriented. And because Agnes is somebody who I think chronically overthinks everything, which then keeps her from actually being able to do any of the things she wants to do. And in all honesty, it keeps her from able to go deeper into relationships. I mean, she obviously ruined the relationship she had with Rios. She probably self-sabotaged that just because of those type of things. And so this is so fascinating to me. It does really make me wonder, like you've said, is she the Borg Queen who comes through the rift? this is, I think, been the most obvious storyline that they've been doing. And so I'm, you know, Rafi is like, what else could go wrong? And of course, a Borg queen on the loose in L.A.
Yeah.
I mean, not that you'd notice that there was a Borg queen on the loose in L.A., because L.A. is weird enough that
there's always something going on.
You just chalk it up to, oh,
right,
that's just L.A.
Yeah. It's just someone from a movie set walking around, you know.
Yeah. 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 I'm sure it's fine.
Yeah. I found this part of the story to be, of course, it's very predictable. But now, what happens for the remaining four episodes? I'm curious, because Agnes, at this point anyway, has walked away from everyone as the Borg Queen, walking down the street in Los Angeles, and it does seem that the Borg Queen herself has some other motive. And now that she has a body and she can go anywhere in this time period, what is she going to do? So it feels like there may be another branch to the Borg Queen story coming up. We've completed the one where the two of them come together, which clearly we've been on track for that since the beginning. And even if I'm correct that the queen that comes through the rift at the beginning of Stargazer is Agnes as the Borg Queen, what happens in between? And what leads them to travel into the future to call for help? That'll be interesting to see. But but I love the way, that Agnes says, you know, you're just a guest. You're just here until I can figure out what I can do with you. And she really thinks that she can push back and she can fight against the Borg Queen and that she's going to be in control. And there are those few moments where the Borg Queen makes it clear that that's not the case, like when she grabs Rios by the tie and pulls him in and kisses him. You know, that's a case of the Borg Queen just completely taking control even before she reaches the level after the performance of the song where she truly takes control and we see the creepy eyes and the smile. And then we know that Agnes is still in there, but it's the Borg Queen who's in the driver's seat now.
I mean, I just kept waiting, you know, with their big distraction for her to be, we are sex bob-a-bomb. 1, 2, 3, 4. So, I mean, from Scott Pilgrim versus right. The World. But they did not go that direction.
They did not go that direction. That's right.
No, which, you know, I understand. But, you know, would have loved it as a Scott Pilgrim fan. But, I mean, I thought their choice was great. And obviously, Alison Pill has an incredible voice. So hopefully that version, it's got to be on the soundtrack when it comes out, because
it probably will
soundtrack worthy.
Yeah, I think so. So well, and even Rafi agrees with you. So Jurati can sing.
Yeah.
She knows. She knows. So talking about the singing, this is something that I, watching the first time, thought, wow, that's like creative genius to choose Shadows of the Night for Jurati to sing. And then I found out that it's not the song that they were going to have her sing, but Alison Pill had an issue with the first choice, and so they changed it to Shadows of the Night. And then it made me wonder, okay, what were you thinking creatively with the first choice? So originally, apparently, they were going to have her sing Nina Simone's Feeling Good, which is a very popular song. It's been covered by dozens of artists over the years, and it's seen as this kind of liberation anthem. But if you look at the lyrics from that song that I think could apply to the situation of Jurati here are four lines. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life for me, and I'm feeling good. That's kind of it. And if you imagine that song playing in this situation, I don't know. To me, it doesn't quite fit the scene. So they chose Shadows of the Night instead. And most people probably know Shadows of the Night from Pat Benatar because she won a Grammy for it in 83. But it was originally written for a movie called Times Square. It was a movie in 1980, which interestingly is about runaways in New York City, whereas here at the end, we've got runaways in Los Angeles with Girardi and the Borg Queen together heading off into the street. But the reason I think it's such a brilliant choice, even though it might be a little bit jarring at first for Star Trek to hear this Shadows of the Night and this arrangement of it, are the lyrics. These are the lyrics, and it sounds like the Borg Queen talking to Agnes. It says, "We're running with the shadows of the night. So, baby, take my hand. You'll be all right. Surrender all your dreams to me tonight. They'll come true in the end. You said, oh, girl, it's a cold world when you keep it all to yourself. I said, you can't hide on the inside all the pain you've ever felt. Ransom my heart, but baby, don't look back because we got nobody else." Doesn't that sound like what the Borg Queen has been saying to Agnes since the beginning of the season?
No, I think it's a much better choice for the music here. I think it really works. I think it's when you think of the idea that they're trying to make a distraction here, I think that the way the song is arranged really works. I mean, it's a freaking show. I don't really care about the logistics. I mean, I know I've seen some people really get on the logistics of like, well, how did they make the spotlight come on? And how did the band know what to play? And I don't know. And I don't really care. Like, those are things to which, like, I could, you know, the Borg Queen, like, scanned whatever the sheet music it is they've got or, you know.
Well, I will tell you, as a musician whatever. Who used to play in that type of a jazz band and play events like that, you've got, first of all, you know a lot of songs when you do this. And also you've got a folder full of sheet music. And if someone wants something, you just pull it up and you play it. So to me as a musician, logistically, yeah, that's not a big deal.
Yeah.
Although Agnes knowing what for her would have been a 450-year-old song, that's more interesting.
Now, see, that's the other thing, though. I picture Agnes being a big fan of 80s rock ballads.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Because she's the type of character who's like so emotionally damaged. The only way right now that she can access those emotions inside of her is by singing them at the top of her lungs while she's working. I mean, she's also the one who has a... in the other universe, a like emotional support animal that's digital.
Right.
You know, she has an emotional support digipet. So, I mean, this is the kind of person who definitely needs some
that's
help.
That's right. So. She's got a futuristic Tamagotchi. And now I'm picturing, I need to create this. There was this meme I saw on Twitter some months ago that I thought perfectly describes me. It was someone crying and they're saying like, "Dad, where is all the great music?" And then the next frame is, "It's in the 80s. It's in the 80s. And that's exactly how Girardi feels, apparently.
Which, as she should. So, Chris, I think one thing that's really interesting that I've seen batted around, and I just wanted to get your opinion on it before we kind of talk about the songs. You know, Rios obviously seems to be really enjoying himself in the 21st century, even though he's spent a lot of time getting beat up in a hospital and in a detention center. You know, he likes the food. He loves the real cigars. He likes the ladies that are here. And so do you think that that's leading anywhere for him? Or do you think that that's just more of somebody who had very little perception of what a different century like this would be like? And just realizing that there is something to love in every century if you're looking for it.
Yeah, that's an interesting question that I haven't thought too much about. It might be that the Rios character we saw in season one was someone who had been in Starfleet, then he was out of Starfleet. I think he was really enjoying the freedom that he had on the La Serena. And he seemed like someone who probably was less comfortable with the structure of Starfleet and maybe the structure of that 24th, early 25th century society that he's living in. And in this season, we see him return to Starfleet, and he's a much more relaxed captain on the bridge of the Stargazer than we're accustomed to as Starfleet captains go. But still, he's not the Rios that we saw in season one. And so it might be that that world, that freedom, that kind of ability of things being a little less structured, a little bit more chaotic, maybe a little more interesting to him, is resurfacing a little bit here. Could be that. I felt like a lot of it is that he's really infatuated with Teresa, and so he's got that glow, right, as Raffi says, and that's kind of coloring his perceptions of the world right now. And all the other stuff that's happening to him is okay because it enabled him to meet Teresa.
Right.
I felt like that's probably the primary thing. I don't know if I think it's going anywhere else for him in this story, because we only have four episodes left. So I don't know how much more they could build off of that. Maybe it might enable him to do something that the others are not comfortable with, that would be normal for someone living in 2024. And I think he can blend into the world of 2024 much better than the others can. Seven can do it pretty well. Jean-Luc, not very well. Raffi, I think, not so well. Girardi, she's got her own mission going at this point. So, yeah, it could be that it helps him take a next step that they need somewhere. But I don't really think it's going to be a big character transition for him. And then, I think this was announced after we recorded last time, wasn't it? The whole casting for season three. So we know that the full TNG cast is coming back, which means that this story pretty sure is going to wrap up at the end of episode 10 of this season. And at the moment, I kind of think we're not going to see Rios and Raffi and Girardi and Seven, I don't know, in season three, because there's going to be this focus on the original Enterprise D crew.
So I wonder if in that then, you know, you could definitely do a spinoff where you've got Rios on the Stargazer, you know, with those other characters, right? So that you've got ways to go with them. Of course, that depends on where you leave them here in this season. I do think, though, one of the beauties and what I loved about Rios, where he's like, oh, God, the food is so good. Yeah. You know, like a lot of people in Star Trek talk about the idea of, like, you know, non-replicated food, you know, the idea of for him to have a real cigar, you know, these type of things to which are very difficult to get in the 25th century, if not impossible. Like, I don't know how many places on Earth are still making cigars at all, if any, you know, so it would
in the 24th century.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I think what it reminded me of, and I think this was nice, because there was that moment in the episode with Guinan where Picard is trying to remind her there's also still good here.
Yeah.
There are things to love about the world that we live in. We see all of these things going wrong all over the place, but so many times it's easy to forget the little things.
Yeah.
And I think that that is very important for us to be able to remember what it means to have good food, good friends, good wine, and maybe a good cigar every once in a while. Mm-hmm.
That makes me think about the comment that Rios makes to Raffi when she talks to him about Teresa, and he lights up and he's like, can you believe, you know, she built that clinic from the ground up, and those people, they didn't have anywhere to go until she came there, and she saves lives. And he likes some of these aspects of 2024 society, like the cigars and things that some people might think are bad, but he is attracted to her because she's doing good for the community. She's saving lives. And so even though there are many bad things in our world today, I think one little comment in this story may be that there are also many good people.
Yep.
And that if people wanted to, we could make society better. We could make the world better. And Rios is taking that Starfleet captain mentality and combining it with someone who's probably more at home in this century and highlighting that Star Trek message of bettering the world, even if things look bleak.
You know, the most interesting thing, and it's really weird because I was just thinking about this, is how, you know, this whole season seems to be about kind of people finding freedom from their baggage, whatever that is. And the one character that we've seen in the 21st century who has been very free of her baggage has been Seven. And Ralph even calls that out about how, you know, the Borg implants create a lot of baggage, and it's nice for her to see Seven free of that for a while.
Yeah.
And in many ways, I'm wondering, because we don't really get a ton of Seven in this episode at all.
No.
I'm interested, though, in the sense that, are they giving us a picture of what their end goal is for these different characters? Which is, we want them basically to be in the place that Seven is now, which is to be able to let go of some of the baggage that they have so that they are less driven by fear and more free to be themselves.
Well, I think that's a central point of the season for most of the characters, and maybe even for Rios, which we were just talking about. You do see him appear lighter here than he did in season one or in the Stargazer.
Good point.
But that's central to the Picard story for sure. It makes perfect sense for the Seven story. And then Raffi is someone who in season one was very bogged down with this emotional turmoil and regret and the need to try to let go. And also, I didn't put it on the outline, but I am wondering, where are they going with these flashes of Elnor that Raffi keeps seeing across the room?
Yeah.
You know, is it just to remind us that she is struggling with his death, or is there something more to that, that that's leading towards something? And, you know, if you mention them allowing each character to let go of this emotional baggage that they're carrying, or the baggage from their past experiences, which may or may not be what we would define as emotional baggage, but things that they feel hold them back, that would make sense that she keeps seeing Elnor. And I think that's going to get resolved in a small way, I think, by the end. I don't know if Elnor is going to come back in the end. I kind of think he probably will come back in the end once they fix what's happened to time. I don't know that he would be resurrected in 2024 or anything along those lines. I haven't thought about it very much. So if they did a spinoff, a Stargazer series with Rios as captain, and they brought Seven and Raffi and Elnor and Jurati, if she survives, over there, would you be interested in a series like that?
I think I would. I've really been enjoying Rios as a character, and in all honesty, he was my favorite character from the first season, even over Picard.
Well, he's such a good actor, for one thing. Even apart from the character, it's just,
Yes. And so I would absolutely be interested in seeing them do something like that, because I think that they would make a really, you know, interesting crew, and to then be able to kind of go and explore this part of the Star Trek universe, I think would be quite interesting. And so, I would be definitely down for that. There's, in all honesty, they've given me no reason to not enjoy, to not want more of these characters.
Well, I will say that they have put a lot of time and money and energy into creating the Stargazer bridge, and it'd be an awful waste if they didn't do something else with it.
Yes. No, I 100% agree with you.
All right. So. Well, okay. Last topic before we wrap up here. The Adam Soong story took a dark twist here, whereas before we felt like he was a father with a daughter who had this genetic disease that forced her to stay inside all the time. She couldn't experience the world or experience life. And he was just desperate to somehow find a cure. We find out here that actually she's the last in a long line of children that he's been experimenting on, creating. It's not clear. I don't think he's creating them, but he appears to be getting children when they're very young and raising them and doing genetic experiments, and they all die. What do you think about this aspect of the story and where it might be leading, and also how it fits in with the overall story? Because it's kind of a big theme to be thrown in here 6 episodes into a 10-episode season.
I think that Adam Soong has been genetically engineering children. And what I mean by that is literally taking, you know, them, growing them in test tubes and doing genetic experiments to try and perfect humanity.
So in that case, he kind of would be creating them.
Exactly.
Trying to create an improved human.
Mm-hmm. And I do think that this is kind of something that is basically a linchpin in the idea of where you get Khan, Noonien, and Singh and the augments, and that this is part of that process. And basically what they're doing is they're adding to that storyline.
I want to ask you about that
How that plays out, I'm not really sure. But I do think it's clear. What's fascinating here, though, is that I think the story kind of shows us what happens when we allow obsession to take over, when we allow ourselves to be capable of doing anything to get whatever it is that we want, you know, willing to break any rule, any convention, any moral boundary, and still, like we see here, you end up with nothing.
Yeah.
Which, you know, for him, I think is really interesting because he can't complete this mission. You know, even though he runs over Picard, he doesn't get the right Picard.
Right.
And he doesn't see any way around it now, especially that she's in quarantine. There's no way for him to get to her. Mm-hmm. And what is really fascinating here is that you kind of see this whole idea of like how much he really doesn't care about Corey as a person. He cares only really about her as a possession, which is that type of possessive love you kind of get when you think of like Star Wars and Anakin with Padme. You know, there's not a lot of real love there. It's more possessional type of obsession. Mm-hmm. And so I find him terrifyingly scary.
Yeah.
And I think you ask a really great question, is exactly where are they going to go with this? Will this be the part of the story where we feel like, oh, that was kind of interesting, but they kind of left that dangling thread? And is that dangling thread maybe then what you go to in season 3 or something? I don't know. But please don't let Picard have to face down a Soong-like character that would just, you know, we don't need, you know, him facing his own Khan. He did that in First Contact. So
yeah, I don't think that.
But yeah, I don't know. I'm really at a loss. I don't even know what to speculate about with this because I'm not sure how it does fit into the rest of this season.
I'm not sure where it's going to go in terms of this story here, but you mentioned Khan, which I think is really interesting because this feels like one of those moments in Star Trek where you can add texture and you can connect dots and make the story more interesting, except that the years don't line up because Khan Space Seed was originally written in the 60s. And so they set it in 1996 being the year that Khan and his people left the Earth. And then Khan himself was born in the middle of the 20th century, and he was one of the genetically engineered humans, one of the augments, which seems to be what Adam Soong is developing right now. So I don't know if maybe you could think that in this timeline, Khan hasn't been born yet. Adam Soong's research is what leads to Khan and those augments. That makes a whole lot more sense for the story. If you try to connect it back to the original series, then it feels like Adam Soong is, what, like 70 years late in doing this? But the way our own history played out, what we know from the original series, Space Seed timeline, none of that happened. So at least in my mind, it makes sense to adjust that.
Right.
Just to think about how the pieces could lead to the next thing that we know of.
And is that what this season might end up doing? Is like shifting everything further out because of that?
Maybe.
Who knows? Yeah. And maybe it's just that he's trying to recreate what was done with Khan, Noonien,
and
Singh.
Yeah, that's true too. Maybe the...
Which I think is another possibility. If that's already supposed to have happened and that's still the case, which I'm totally okay with, you know, to see that there would be a geneticist trying to recreate that for what was lost or what he thought was lost and what is needed maybe for humanity to overcome whatever issues he thinks that are needed to be overcome in this time period, I could 100% see that being what he's trying to do. So yeah. I think that's also something that really works.
Well, that makes sense because in all likelihood, there would have been an attempt anyway to destroy all of the knowledge of how to create those augments.
Right.
And so he may be trying to recreate that again. He could be using bits of that knowledge that are left behind to create augments once again. It's entirely possible. Mm-hmm. It's also possible that just events play out differently in this altered timeline. And of course, we could do a whole podcast debating whether the past changed or not. And even the story, the writing isn't clear, which is why we talked a few episodes of The Artificial Tango ago about how we feel time is shattered instead of simply being altered. And if time has been shattered, then again, you know, the the birth of Khan and the creation of the augments and the eugenics wars and everything could happen later. The fact that they have this panel, though, that is so opposed to eugenics research, and you see all those headlines about eugenics when Corey is doing searches, makes me feel like something has happened in the past, and they're trying to make sure it doesn't happen again. Yeah.
100%. 100%. And, you know, I think one of the things that we did not discuss was when Picard is on the table and they're having the argument of whether or not Talon is going to go into his mind. You know, Rafi says that his mind is protecting him and we need to allow his mind to do what it needs to do. And I loved her phrase where she says, a lot of what we do is protective. It doesn't mean it's good for us.
Yeah.
And I thought if there was a line that was more poignant for our society, because a lot of what we see happening in our world is for people for protection, but that doesn't mean it's good for us. And really, what our world lacks is a sense of being willing to risk, knowing the risks and doing it anyway, right? That's courage. And in many ways, you know, I think the world needs just a little bit more of the John Wayne attitude, which is courage is being scared to death and saddling it up anyway. And that what she said there, I found so moving. I was kind of floored that the show was kind of saying this thing, which I think is so important. And so I really appreciated that. And I'm really excited then to kind of see where this risk takes us, because we're taking a risk with Picard, right? Doing this show in the first place is a risk. because it's a beloved character. All you can really do in many ways is ruin the character most people feel. There's no reason to revisit at this point. And so this is about, can we make this risk worth it? And, you know, so far, season two is saying, yeah, we really can. So,
yeah, I love the writing on the show because I feel like they're taking a more honest look at our society and who we are as people than some of the other writing on TV these days does. It's a bit from both sides of issues, I feel. So I like that. I do want to say, Matthew, that I must have misunderstood because I thought that courage was removing the headphone jack from the iPhone. That's what Phil Schiller told me. So got to have courage. All right. What are your final thoughts on this episode and what's your rating?
Okay. I really liked this episode. I've saw quite a few people complaining about the time that this episode takes and the fact that it is a shorter episode.
Yeah.
But I thought this was a perfect example of the fact that you have these shows that do not have to be a specific length and using the time to your advantage. So you are legitimately telling a story within the same amount of time that you actually say you have this much time.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah.
And I thought that that was great because it gives a real sense of urgency, right? And in many ways, we also didn't know that Picard was going to complete the mission with Rene. So the whole episode, you are on the edge of your seat. Like, is he going to be able to do this before this thing happens where he's on a hospital bed? We don't know. So it gives more tension to the episode. So all in all, I thought this was a fantastic episode of Picard. I was very pleased with it. And I'd say, goodness, this is 4 out of 5 red dresses.
There's only one red dress, Matthew, and it's being worn by Allison Pill.
That's true. It is definitely being worn by Allison Pill.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I love this episode as well. I think the length is fine. Most of the new seasons of Star Trek, Discovery, Picard, have had these episodes that are in the 37, 38 minute range. At some point, there's been at least one of them. And like you, I think one of the greatest benefits of the streaming format is that you're not beholden to commercials and you take the time you need to tell a story and you don't need to pad to hit a certain target and you don't need to cut to hit a certain target. And so this one worked well, and especially with the format of the storytelling here, I think it worked quite well. And there's just a lot of great stuff in this. For a 30, I think it was 38 minutes, including the long recap at the beginning and the title sequence. So the actual story is like 33, 4 minutes. They packed so much in, and bits that were very true to Star Trek and to Jean-Luc as a character. And I think set us up for a very interesting run here to the end of the story. So I'm going to give this 1.8 real cigars.
Perfect.
Well, we would love to hear your thoughts on Two of One as well. There are many ways for you to share those. Perhaps the best way is to go to the Babel Conference on Facebook. That is our closed listeners group. If you're already a member, you know where to go. But if not, just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field, and it should come right on up. If not, just type the whole name, the Babel Conference. It is a closed group, as I mentioned, so please answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. We'll put a post in there for this episode, and you can share your comments with us and fellow listeners and continue the discussion from the podcast there in the Babel Conference. If you'd like to send us email, you can do that by going to our website, trek.fm/contact, choose to send to a show, and choose the artificial tango. And that message will come right over to Matthew and me by email. You can also find us everywhere in social media. Our username is TrekFM. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, all over the place. Twitter is a great way to connect with us, and we would love to hear your thoughts there. Now, Matthew, when you're not, you know, trying to pin some bad things that happened on some kids, which the good guys would never do. Where can people find you?
Well, when I'm not doing that, Chris, you can find me on social media under the name MattRushing02, Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, Vero, any of those type of places. You can also find me here on the network on our whole other side of the network, talking about all the fandoms we love that aren't Star Trek related. So we've got the 602 Club where we do that, and we've got some great bonus shows in that same feed we'd love for you to check out. You can also find me here doing Literary Treks, The Orb, and Warp 5. Literary Treks is about the books and the comics of Star Trek. The Orb is about Star Trek Deep Space Nine, Chris, where we talk about one of our favorite shows of all time. And then, of course, Warp 5, we are walking through every single episode of that series in celebration of 20 years of Star Trek Enterprise. And then over on the Nerd Party Network, you'll find me doing two shows. One is a completed show I did with Drea Kaufman, where he talked about Harry Potter one chapter at a time on Owlpost. And Aggressive Negotiations with John Mills, as we're talking about Star Wars each and every week. But Chris, if people want to catch up with you and see what else you've got going on, where can they find you?
Well, you can find me elsewhere on the network, as you mentioned, talking Enterprise with you on Warp 5, DS9 on The Orb. I have Interphase, which is a Star Trek Universe podcast, and Larry Nemechek and I do The Ready Room from time to time. And on social media, you can catch me on Twitter. That's where I'm most active. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. I'd love to chat with you about Picard or Star Trek in general or Japan or music, 80s music, of course, or whatever you'd like to chat about. So hit me up there. And then, of course, I'm always working on behind the scenes things here at the network as well. Speaking of which, if you would like to help us keep this show and the 602 Club side of the network and everything that we're doing going, we could definitely use your help. It takes a lot of money to keep the network going, to get these shows out to you, and it's been a rough couple of years with the pandemic. So if you'd like to help us out and get involved in the network, please visit patreon.com/trekfm to find out how. That's patreon.com/trekfm. You can become an associate producer. You can get involved in the network in other ways, and we would love to have your support. Speaking of associate producers, we would like to send a huge thank you to Cornelia Rutner, who is our associate producer here on the Artificial Tango. Cornelia, thank you so much for your support, helping us keep this all going. And thank you also to everyone who's supporting the network. We would not be here without you. Well, Matthew, I am ready to delve into Jean-Luc's mind next time we do the Artificial Tango.
Chris, make it so.